Welcome back, everyone. We're going to begin the third and final hour of this edition of Narsalan Action. And we're going to have two guests, one that hasn't been announced yet, but she's about to be. And we're going to have Ashley from the Liberty and Justice Coalition. Is Ashley with us, Andy?
Yes, she is.
I'm here.
Okay, Ashley. And we have Lynette with us, who's gonna usurp the first few minutes of the program. Let me do a little housekeeping, and then we're going to welcome Lynette. And so those of you who haven't entered the prize contest, you better do it now, because as they say in the South, we're fixing to draw the winner in this hour. So if you haven't texted prize yet, text 747-227-4477. And Ashley Cloud is the staff attorney for New Mexico's Liberty and Justice Coalition, and we're going to get to her in a moment. But we haven't had a report for some time from the state of Rhode Island. And I asked the ACLU, which has been involved in litigation, which has dragged on for some time, if they could provide someone to give us a report. And they offered Lynette. So, Lynette, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
And I'm not even sure. I didn't get a bio from Steve, so I'm not sure what your connection is to the lawsuit. So if you want to give a little mini bio of who, before we talk about that, that'd be great.
Sure. I'm an attorney in private practice in Rhode Island. I'm closely associated with the ACLU of Rhode Island, do a lot of ACLU of Rhode Island cases. I'm one of the two attorneys for the plaintiffs in the lawsuit that we started in 2015, challenging Rhode Island's sex offender law, which prohibits level three sex offenders from residing within 1,000 feet of a school, public or private. The case has gone on for quite some time. We got a restraining order when we filed the lawsuit, so the law has not been in effect. We're really happy about that. Over the last several years, we were moving forward with the litigation, and then the state of Rhode Island amended the law, and they've amended it a couple times. And the newest amendment scheduled to take effect July 1 of 2020. We've got the restraining order and we've been moving forward on the case. We're going to try it on the amendments that have gone in, that are going into effect July 1 of 2020, which the amendments provide some further information as to how to calculate or measure the 1,000 feet. And some further information about what's a school and what isn't that we had challenged in 2015. So they've tightened it in some respects because one of our challenges has to do with vagueness. And in other respects, they've created new definitional issues, as well as we think, made it more onerous. As the case has progressed, we now have added an associational plaintiff, the Rhode Island Homeless Advocacy Project, as a plaintiff, and we've also been certified as a class action. And we're doing discovery on the, primarily with respect to the new amendments. And after we complete discovery, we expect to try to work out some stipulation of fact and then have a trial. So sometime probably later this year.
Well, Lynette, this is a case that's very dear to our heart at NARSL because the hideous nature of that there's residency restrictions. They're not novel to Rhode Island, but it was touching to us because they gave people directive to move out retroactively. These people had been in these places in some cases for years. And they were ordered to vacate their premises with a very short period of time. We felt like that if they were able to do that in Rhode Island, that would be a cancer that would spread across the country. It's hideous enough to have in America, you can't live where you'd like to live and where you can afford to live. But it's even more hideous when you've been living there and owning the place, and they come in and give you papers and say you shall vacate within 30 days. And that's what they did. So NARSL's donors, we were able to put a modest amount of money to help the ACLU, which is a relatively small chapter in Rhode Island. and I guess you're cooperating a cooperating attorney with the ACLU. But this has been a protracted case, which is, again, one of my points that I make when we're doing these challenges. These things, they fight for years, and they fight over the most simple things. And that's what they've been doing, right?
Oh, no question about it. I mean, you know, we, you know, to be really blunt about it, because we have a restraining order, we're not in a giant rush. I mean, if we didn't have a restraining order, we would have really, you know, demanded that the case move forward faster. As it turned out, no one has been displaced. That's the real beauty of the restraining order that's been in place. But some of our plaintiffs, I mean, just to give you an illustration, one is legally blind. He lives with his mother, and the nearest school, so-called, is across a four-lane highway. But they said that he would, you know, that that's within 1,000 feet. And there's no exceptions for, you know, intervening bodies of water or highways or, you know, structures that prevent you from getting anywhere within 1,000 feet. And another one owns a house with his mother and a disabled brother, and, you know, and there's no exception for home ownership or family relationships. And of course, it's very, very disruptive to people, you know, who need to live near where they work or where they get counseling. And it makes no sense at all, because it affects, I mean, even on the theory that they're not supposed to be around children, because it's where they live, not where they spend their days. So I guess we, you know, in a backhanded way, we should be fortunate compared to some other states where it's not just where they live, but also bus stops where they work and everything, and churches and where they worship and everything else. But it's bad, and we, you know, when we continue to move forward on it, I hope that we're going to be able to convince the court that it is, you know, violates ex post facto due process, of, you know, family relationships, which is either protected by due process, First Amendment, freedom of association, and so forth. But, we're still in the, fact collecting phase, because they changed the law, so we had to regroup.
Well, Ashley, Ashley is going to be our guest in momentarily. Did you have any questions about this Rhode Island litigation before we thank our special guest for dropping in with us?
How did they change the legislation so that you had to regroup? What
Say
did they do
again?
Specifically? How did they change the legislation?
Right. So what they did was it originally said it would be a felony if you reside within 1,000 feet of a school, public or private. And there were no, and so we challenged that there's no definition of a school. And in discovery, they said, well, a school is pre-K through 12, but not daycares and not colleges and not, you know, beauty schools or whatever else. And of course, we were saying, how do you know that you're making that up? Because it was nothing in the statute. And so they came back and they amended the statute, and now it defines a school as K through 12, knocked out the pre-K, and made it clear that it's not daycare or secondary school or professional schools. So we had a mapping expert who was developing, you know, maps to show the impact of the legislation. So we have to regroup in terms of our maps. The other thing is that they did not have a define how you measured 1,000 feet. So they amended the statute to say that it's from the nearest property line of the school or the property supporting the school to the nearest property line of the residence or the property supporting the residence. And by adding those words, property supporting the residence, it just created a whole new definitional issue, which we're currently in discovery, trying to force them to say, well, what does that mean? Because once again, they're saying, well, it doesn't mean a town building, but it does, you know, I actually don't know at this point, because they've refused to answer the interrogatories, where, you know, we're in discovery dispute. If they're saying that a parking lot is part of the property that supports the school, a playing field nearby that might be shared, you know, like with a church, if it's a parochial school. So these are things that we need to try to pin them down on, or at least be able to argue about it and then redraw our maps. So when we're before the court explaining just how devastating the impact is, we're using, if we either agreed upon definitions or showing that it's so confusing and vague that that's another reason why it should be struck down, because people really don't know how to conform their conduct to avoid being prosecuted.
Well, I wish you the best of luck on that.
So,
thank you. Appreciate it.
On behalf of NARSL and our supporters and donors, we're grateful for the work you're doing, and it's been 5 years in the making, and you're optimistic that there might be a trial in 2020. So after 6 years, you might get to go to trial.
I think so, yeah.
So, well, I know you've got a ton of billable hours, and there's a lot of work going into this. And as I'll communicate with Steve at the ACLU, that NARSL is certainly interested, and we can go back to our board if there's any more support needed, because we want this case to be won, and we want to telegraph to the nation, you just can't go in and remove people and uproot them from their homes. Sorry, there's a line drawn in the sand. This will be fought every time you attempt to do this anywhere.
Well, we appreciate your support, and we really have needed it, because it's, you know, these, every time they've changed what they've given us, our mapping expert has a ton more work to do, and he's still waiting for us to give him the last go round, and we'll be getting another report and needing his testimony. So we definitely appreciate your support, and both moral and economic.
We appreciate what you're doing. And thank you for taking the time to drop in tonight. On very short notice, I had sent the request to Steve, and he had misdirected it, and so he had to scramble to try to find a way to accommodate the request, and we appreciate it.
Yes, and I'm happy to help, and not an issue at all. Thank you.
I may reach out to you again. And I'm going to move
Thank
on with the program.
I'm going to sign off now.
All right. Good night.
Good night.
All right. So now we're back to what we had planned for this hour. Ashley, do you think you and I can blab for 45 minutes?
I'm pretty sure between the two of us, we can blab for 45 minutes.
Yeah. The number of people has dwindled. We've still got a good crowd, but it has dwindled from where it was initially. I think we should go ahead and pick the prize contest winner and get that out. Then the rest of the people can hang up.
They're waiting to get the last 2 minutes, so they all have to stick around.
that is so rude, Andy.
I'm sorry.
Do you want to roll the drum now? Do you want to give one more chance? I announced it at the top of the hour. Do you want to go ahead and roll the drum?
Give it one more chance.
Okay, so we're going to pick it by the bottom of the hour for sure. If you haven't entered, text 747-227-4477. And this will cover your registration to the 2020 conference, not your travel, not your hotel, but your registration. If you've already paid, you can roll it over to 2021, or you can transfer it to someone else. I don't want to say we'll refund it, because I haven't got that decision made yet, but you can certainly use it for 2021 conference, which we'll be announcing the location of that one very soon. So please enter if you want to be in the drawing. All right, Ashley, you are here.
And I am here.
You are here, and you've been here before. You've been on the Registry Matters podcast. And so I guess I'm just going to give you a mini introduction since you've been here before. You're the staff attorney for Liberty and Justice Coalition, which is the NARSL affiliate. And you prosecuted for a long, long time, prosecuting everything from DWI to sex crimes to domestic violence, homicide. Did you prosecute any obscene harassing phone calls in your career?
No, never.
You never did that?
That's a funny question, Larry.
So So for a better part of 8 months, you've been out of the prosecutor's office and you've moved over to the defense, and you're building a defense practice with your diligence, and you're also putting effort into trying to make a difference with what we refer to as impact litigation. And we have filed an impact case in New Mexico dealing with out-of-state offenses for those who have been convicted in a jurisdiction other than the state of New Mexico. Why is that? I mean, actually, it's straightforward. If you had to register in Georgia, you should have to register in New Mexico. Why are you people always causing problems and filing these frivolous lawsuits? Why are you in court on this issue of out-of-state translation?
Well, since I'm a rabble-rouser by nature, it was necessary to file this lawsuit, Larry. It isn't that you just have to register here because you have to register in another state. That's not what the statute says here. It's not what case law says here. It says New Mexico law requires an out-of-state offense to be equivalent to an offense on our list, meaning that if you have a conviction for another state, or maybe you were convicted as a juvenile, or there's a whole host of reasons, you have to get a translation here before you're obligated to register here. It is apples to apples and oranges to oranges.
Okay, but now equivalent. I mean, states, I'm being devil's advocate here. States have different titles for their offenses. Equivalent is an absolute word. Wouldn't it make more sense if you guys just, well, it's close enough. It's substantially similar. It's reasonably similar. It has the similar elements. Why are you guys so obsessed about this word equivalent?
What is it they say? Close only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades, Larry, not in lawsuits. The term case equivalent must be the facts, the underlying facts must be equivalent to the offense here. If the legislation had intended for it to be substantially similar, sufficient, any of those other words, they would have put that in there, but they didn't. They put equivalent. It must be the same.
Okay, so you, when you move to New Mexico and you have a conviction in Georgia, they must, I mean, this law has been on the books. I looked at it. It's New Mexico started registration in 95. They must have developed a process by now to translate out-of-state offenses. So is it just a matter of them taking a little bit of time? Are you guys so impatient that you can't wait for them to do the translations? For God's sakes, give them time.
Some of the people on our registration have been awaiting translation for 20 years. I think that's 20, more than enough time.
20 years?
Mm-hmm. Some of them have been awaiting translation that long. Others have been awaiting translation in various stages. And literally, that's what it says. And if New Mexico defaulted to an easy registration, and I'm not saying there is technically an easy registration, but there are grades of it. If they defaulted to just registering once a year for 10 years and not being on the published website, that would be one thing. But they're defaulting to the every 90 days. And all the other requirements that are in the latest version.
Okay, so let me get this straight. You go to New Mexico, and it has to be equivalent. So they go ahead and register you in the most harsh way they can, which is every 90 days, and they tell you you have a lifetime obligation, and then they leave you hanging on the website in limbo for 5, 10, 15, 20 years? Is that what's happening there?
That's exactly what's happening. There has been case after case that has told them they have to do something. And the way that the case law actually reads is that they have the best place for this to happen is in district court. And I mean, I think some of those lawsuits dated back there, what, going on 10 years, somewhere in that time frame. And they've been telling them all this time. The courts have been telling them, legislature has been telling them, you have to come up with a process. And they haven't come up with a process, so we were forced to sue.
So it isn't just greedy lawyers trying to figure out something to do. This was a problem that has not been able to be rectified for 20 years.
Yes.
Okay. Well, exactly. I wanted to get that out there because we took some heat saying, why didn't you people just call us? Well, we've been suing you and challenging you for 20 years now. About this, the controlling case, State versus Hall, came out in 2011, and you've had clear guidance for almost 10 years. What the court expects you to do, and you haven't done it. So that's why we're suing. That's why we've sued. Okay, so we've got that out of the way. what's the process of that suit? So the lawsuit was filed, and since we have a slam dunk case, the state has just capitulated and worked in good faith, and they're trying to resolve this, right?
Sure, that's the way lawsuits go down, Larry. Yeah, no, that's not what happened. So we filed the lawsuit, and initially it looked like they were willing to talk to us right away and discuss a resolution. And before we could even file anything else or even get down the path of settlement, they filed a motion to dismiss. They wrote us numerous times and asked us to dismiss the case, dismiss out different plaintiffs for various reasons. And we said no. So they filed a motion to dismiss. And while that was pending, before we could even get our response in, the legislative session hit and they went and tried to have the laws changed so that it would moot the lawsuit.
The law would say what that they proposed?
That anybody who registered in another state had to register here. And then it did a whole bunch of other things, like even if they had gotten a conditional discharge, even if they didn't, they had been convicted as a juvenile, it didn't matter. If you had to register in another state, you had to register here, and it did away with all the due process requirements that we're demanding.
And those laws typically sail through the legislature. Now, what happened in New Mexico? How did that fare this session?
They went nowhere. You and I dug our heels in and spent, what, how many nights, how many weekends? I think I was sitting at an airport looking at drafted legislation in between plane flights, making sure that these went nowhere. We pulled in every resource that we had. We dug our heels in and said no, and gave them reasons why, and gave them reasons why it was bad law and everything else. And I think at least one of them got tabled, and the other ones didn't make it out of either the House or something else. I'll let you update on that. Yeah. But the bottom line is they didn't make it through the 30-day session.
Well, I'm trying to let people know that these things can be dealt with. You have to have good relationships. You have to have a lot of respect. You have to have good advocacy partners, allies, which we do. We have the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We have the Public Defender's Office. And we work all together as a team in collaboration working on this. But you, if you have relationships with key analysts and key committee chairpersons, you can get traction. Even they thought it was a slam dunk. They put this bill in the first one that was tabled. Then they came back and they combined this provision with human trafficking, and they sensationalized Jeffrey Epstein, who happened to own a ranch over here in Stanley. And said that when you throw everything human trafficking, you should cause people's knees to buckle, because if it's human trafficking, you have to vote yes. So they combined a bill to require everybody to register if you had a registration obligation in any state here with human trafficking. They sensationalized it with Jeffrey Epstein, and they still failed. So our liberty and justice track record of beating everything since 2007 remains intact.
Yes, it does. And I can't say strongly enough how the relationships cultivated over years and all the hard work and everything went into this, because it really did. It made the difference, because you're absolutely right. They sensationalized Jeffrey Epstein, and then they took some horrible, horrible local cases that were very publicized and tried to just throw these comprehensive bills with human trafficking and everybody's going to go out and rape and kill small children all the time unless we do something. Literally, we shut it down.
So we have a motion to dismiss in our lawsuit. We didn't file a motion, but the defendants, the sheriffs and the state, have filed a motion to dismiss. And we are waiting, I think, for a decision on that. Everybody wants to know, when will the court rule? Is there a deadline when the court has to rule on a motion to dismiss, or could it sit there for a while?
It could sit there for a while. And a little bit more about the procedures. So they filed their motion to dismiss, and then we filed a response, and then they get to reply to that response. When they did it, they literally timed it so that a case had come out of Utah the day before that we didn't know about, but it happened right. They were just waiting to hand in theirs, to cite that case, knowing that we probably hadn't caught it, which we didn't, because it was within 24 hours. And then they tried to make it so the judge was going to rule on it just based on that. But we actually partnered up with some other lawyers and did a motion to leave to file a SIR reply, and the judge was on to them using trying to use that case at the last minute. So they let us file the SIR reply, and now the other agency is following the same path and doing the responses and everything else. So it could be a while. It really could. But I think everybody in this case is just hoping to get a ruling sometime soon. I mean, the issue is very straightforward.
Well, if the judge rules that the case is not dismissed and it goes forward, what are we really trying to decide? I mean, to the average person, it looks equivalent, looks pretty straightforward. Due process seems pretty simple. What is the complexity of this case that's gonna bog it down if the judge doesn't dismiss it for various reasons that would take too long to get into? But if we survive the motion to dismiss, what's left to decide?
What kind of process there actually will be and who's responsible for it. So that's what it kind of is. Everybody is pointing fingers at everybody else in terms of the defendants, because the sheriffs are saying, well, it's not on us to register. And the Department of Public Safety is saying, we have nothing to do with it, but they do. And by statute, they each have their jobs. So now the big question and what we need to work out either through the lawsuit or through settlement negotiations is, what does that process look like? What happens when you set foot in New Mexico? What kind of time frame are we talking about? Where is it filed? Who has the burden of proof? Do they send out letters? And so we've kind of come up with some outline processes for it. And I think that when we hit that, I think we can pretty much work through it, but it's going to be time consuming and expensive for the defendants involved. So that's part of the reason why they're digging in their heels. Due process is expensive.
Yes. I tell people who continuously say, well, why don't you just get a risk-based system? Well, to do risk-based properly, if you don't just use a simple static 99 and have the sheriff's deputy that takes the registration fill it out, if you do something that's real based on real risk, that costs money. It costs money to have that due process. You got to have a team of experts to evaluate the person. They have to have representation so that they can combat whatever they propose the risk level to be. So it means you have to have an appellate process that costs money. And then does the indigent person, do they get to have paid representation? Who pays for it? I mean, there's all these issues. Well, due process costs money. If you're going to have a sex offender registry and you're not going to try to have a bloated one that registers everybody, and you're going to have the language for equivalent, which is the right way to go, then you should prepare to spend a little bit of money to figure out if these people are covered under your law. I'm sorry, it costs money, but that's the reality of it. It's going to cost some money to have due process. I know it's inconvenient, but it's going to need to be done.
That's correct, Larry.
So, well, Andy, it is time to roll that drum.
All right. Let me get to that screen, and I'm going to randomize the numbers, which would be the drum roll. Hang on 1 second. So we'll... Did that come through okay?
That's the best drum roll after all the years we've been doing this.
That's all I can come up with for now. All right. I have a code for you, Larry. Are you ready for the four digits?
Let's have it.
The code is 4826. If you have 4826, please send me a text message at 747-227-4477, which is the number you already enrolled in, but 747-227-4477. And we can then award you that prize.
And we will move on to another selection if that person is not listening at this point. Mm-hmm. Because we want you to hang on the whole point. This is a game to get you to listen to the broadcast. So if you're not listening, you forfeit your prize. So we're going to give people a chance to text and say, I'm the winner. And we know what number, because you recorded every number that you awarded a contestant to, right?
I did.
Number two.
I know that this person isn't listening.
You know this person isn't listening.
I can guarantee you. So we should move to the next number.
Think we need to roll the drums and pick another?
Yes. All right. So we will do 8590. That is the winning number, the winning raffle ticket. You are the number one person on our list. 8590.
And if that person's listening, please text. Be funny if nobody's listening. We've run them all off.
We could have run them all off. Why don't you and Ashley go on to the next topic for a few minutes?
We've covered the primary topic. I wanted to get into some potential lawsuits, and I'm going to go to phone calls. So folks, there's people in the queue, if you want to ask questions about the preceding 2 hours, those may be more difficult. But if you want to ask questions, we'll try about those who have questions that didn't get answered previously. And if you want to ask questions about New Mexico specific, we'll be better prepared for those. So Star 6 will get you in the queue. Ashley, you guys had an ambitious, us guys had an ambitious litigation agenda. What appears to be lining up to be the next challenge or two? Because this case, as it sits for a while, will be less distracting while we're waiting for the judge to rule. So what are we going to do next in the state of New Mexico?
So Larry, we learned a lot of lessons through this lawsuit. For example, the judge won't let us file John Doe's most likely. So we had to go back to the drawing board on a couple of stuff, things. And then the legislative session is now finally done. So I feel pretty good that we're geared up for the next things. Ideally, what we would have filed next were on the in-house parole and the parole not getting a review hearing after your 5 years. Unfortunately, what we're finding, we sent out multiple letters and letters of representation to our potential plaintiffs that we had identified in these categories. And I don't know if it's coincidental. I don't know what it is, but all the ones that we sent out for in-house parole, except for two, actually got released. So, which is great for them, but that left us with very few plaintiffs in that area. So on the review hearings, the issue that we ran into, we just have a couple of those that we got back. And the problem is they're already represented as of the last 2 weeks and have active habeases on that issue that are being heard in court. So that's great for them too. This is all good news because what we really care about is change. But that kind of takes us back to other lawsuits. And so our main focus, which has been all this time, it's just very, very convoluted and time consuming, is challenging the probation and parole conditions. In particular, we are challenging in three areas, but we have 20 plaintiffs now across a couple of categories, mostly in the areas of undisclosed relationship and smartphone and internet bans. And what that means for anybody that might be listening outside of the state of New Mexico is that if you're on probation or parole here, you have to sign a behavioral contract. One of the clauses states that you cannot be in an undisclosed relationship and it has to be pre-approved and all this other stuff. The other part of that, the smartphone and internet, it does not actually prevent you from having a smartphone. It does, however, prevent you from having an undisclosed device, which includes tablets, smartphones. They're using it as very, very comprehensive. And then there's a blanket ban on social media, Facebook, Craigslist, OfferUp, things that absolutely have nothing to do with anything other than some social aspect. LinkedIn is included. So we are challenging those because there is good case law that came down that states that you can't have those blanket bans. And I actually was speaking to a reporter not too long ago who I gave him a copy of the behavioral contract, and he just glanced at it. We were talking about something else, and he immediately keyed on the relationship clause and said, "Is that constitutional?" And what's your response, Larry, whenever somebody asks us if probation and parole can do something?
Well, the answer is that they can do it until they're stopped, and it requires a lot of effort to stop them. They don't have self-containment measures to stop themselves, so we end up with too many things that need to be challenged and not enough resources to challenge them. But yes, that is ridiculously unconstitutional.
Yes, it is. So I am gathering right now. I'm in the middle of drafting and trying to get all the cases together. I have a ton of case law on everything, but I'm trying to make it pretty specific. And I'm also including the fact that they're using, here in New Mexico, they're using the smartphone ban. They've been told by two chief judges in two different jurisdictions that it is not a violation of probation to own a smartphone, but what they're using it as a basis for warrantless searches that are also contrary to New Mexico and federal law. So we've got a lot going on these. It's kind of hard to keep them narrow, but there's so many people affected.
Well, for the national audience, there's people outside the state listening. Let's drill into the parole a little bit, because people are going to misconstrue. We're already getting letters from Indiana and Illinois and Michigan and all over the country. Well, when you hear the term parole, what you typically think about is a person who was sentenced to a period of incarceration and they're released early, you're sentenced to 20 years, you're eligible to be paroled after serving one-fourth, one-third, one-sixth, some amount of that. In our state, we don't have that. We have you serve all of that 20 years, less any good time awards you might receive, which could be as little as 15%, as much as 50%, depending on the crime. And then you are obligated to serve an indeterminate period of what we call parole, but it's actually after you've paid your debt to society in full. And it's similar to what happens in Illinois with that mandatory supervised release that they have. They serve all their time in Illinois, then they go into a period of MSR, and they hold them in prison because they don't like their proposed residential plan. Well, that's what we have here. We have people who are not being released. Now, I do find it a little coincidental that people are being released as we execute representation agreements. And some of those people have been sitting there for some time. So it's, yes. It suggests that there's possibly a connection.
If it had just been one or two people, I might have thought, okay, it's a coincidence. But we sent out 12 letters, and all but two have been released.
Well, I know that I specifically called the attorney for that agency some years ago, and I said, I've got this novel theory I'm going to try. And I thought I'd run it past you before I try it, but we're going to be drafting a complaint, and here's where we're going with it. And he got released within a week before I could even get the complaint drafted. But we haven't called anybody, but all I'm suggesting is that perhaps the confidential prison mail is not as confidential as it ought to be. And in fact, we received a letter back from Las Lunas, from a prison there, that it was rejected because the person wasn't there, and yet it was stamped attorney-client privileged, and it was opened before they returned it to us. I don't even know if I showed that with you, but we got one back that had been opened prior to being returned.
Yes.
So anyway, we already knew that they're going to try to pick our plaintiffs off as if we file a lawsuit. That's a standard practice to try to moot the case by giving the people the relief they're seeking and saying there's no longer a justiciable controversy. But we didn't expect people to get out in droves before we even filed the lawsuit.
No, I was not anticipating that.
So, well, we've got a stack of people in the queue, so let's just take some calls. People love asking. So let's do it. You're on Liberty and Justice. You're on Arsenal in Action with Ashley Cloud from the Liberty and Justice Coalition. Go ahead. All right. I'm going to put you on hold and come back to you. Area code 818, you're on in Action. I'll get it right here sooner or later. Go ahead with your question.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate it. I'm in Los Angeles. I am familiar with Axel. I've been participating in their meetings and conference. This is the first time I've really participated with NARSO. I do appreciate your efforts. Thank you so much. I grew up in New Mexico. I live in Northern New Mexico. Right now I'm living in Southern California. Convicted of a felony, registrant. My probation is just about up in May. I would like to go visit my mom and eventually move back to New Mexico. I'm not sure with the tiered registration what's happening with me. The case that you're talking about now seems very relevant to me. I have some internet, it's an internet case, not CP, but internet case. And so everything that you're talking about is brand new to me. I wanted to see if you can give me some references where I can, get up to speed on what these issues are.
Well, let me say that you may want to contact Ashley in terms of possibly some personal representation, because we would be more than delighted to talk to you, but it may be a little bit more complicated for this call. The baseline is when you come here, they're going to tell you have to register because you're registering in California. And then we're going to have to fight depending on if your crime is equivalent. And unless you feel like telling the listening audience what your crime is and all the details, and we'd have to go through that, we don't know whether you would translate to a registrable offense here in New Mexico. Was it electronic solicitation? Can you say that much? What was the essence of the conviction?
Essentially that's it. So the terminology in California is a 288, I guess, I believe. Well, I don't want to get into the sub numbers because I could get it wrong. The description is harmful matter to a minor. So communication with a minor.
Were there images exchanged, or was sex proposition requested?
No, just text and sex proposition. Well, not explicit sex proposition. There was a.
You
I went to go visit.
you may have a very good cause of action for not having to register if you were to come here. I'm going to take down your number, and do you mind if we call you after the program in the next day or so? Because this is something where you might be able to be helped. So I've got you the number you're calling in from. Great. Is that a real number or is that a fake number?
No, it's not. That's fine. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Well, we've got your number here, and I'll put you on the list for a callback. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Area code 505. You're on Arsal with Ashley Cloud.
Hi, Ashley. My name is Ed. I'm from Albuquerque, and I follow the legislation. Hang on just a second. I followed the legislation through the legislature pretty closely. Hello?
Yes, we can hear you.
Oh, okay. And I'm worried about what will happen in the long session because HB 237 and 43 for 237, they just ran out of time. It never made it through the Justice Committee in the Senate. What are the plans for that, or what's the plan of attack? Because I'm really interested in, because these people are going to come back again next year, and try to push this legislation. I'm just wondering what the
And you're completely Hello? Right. They will come back. You're completely right. They will come back. They will come back year after year after year, as they've been doing since 2007. You're not completely right that they just simply ran out of time. There was more than enough time to pass this had they wanted to, and I'm going to mute you because of all the background noise that's coming in. But there was more than enough time to get this through the legislative process. For those looking in from the outside, when something crosses over from the House to the Senate in the final 3, 4, 5 days, they say it's doomed. No, it's not doomed. What they do is they give it one committee assignment, and then that committee, if it's a high priority legislation from the governor and from the attorney general, that committee is put under extreme pressure to hear that legislation and to give it a hearing. It didn't get a hearing because of the work that was done, not because there was not sufficient time. There was a ton of work, analyses put in, and personal appeals made, and they decided not to hear it. So the plan of action would be exactly what the plan has been since 2007. The plan of action would be that we would continue to hope that the people of New Mexico elect enlightened lawmakers to in sufficient quantity that we have enough to work with in key positions. And we'll continue to try to provide valid information to those enlightened lawmakers. And we'll continue to try to derail their legislation that they put forward as bad public policy. And that's what our plan is always the same. There's no deviation. We are always in the killing business when there's a bad public policy proposed. And we try to get support from whomever we can. Usually it's not from the conservative side, but sometimes it is. We get some support from conservatives, but we derail legislation with good information, good relationships, and with hard work. That's what happens, and that'll be the plan for 2021. Did you have anything to add, Ashley?
The only thing I would add is that we're already starting to work on legislation for 2021 and what we're going to need to derail, because like Larry said, we know this bill is going to come back. We know several of the bills are going to come back, but we're already talking to the Defense Lawyers Association, ACLU, and several other key organizations as well, trying to band together and anticipate what's going to come up and utilize those key relationships and everything else that Larry's referring to derail these bills. So we're already prepared.
And in addition, we're the only state that has an alternate piece of legislation. We didn't roll it out this year because it was a session where only bills that were messaged by the governor's office could be considered. But we have an alternative bill, and in the long session, if it needs to be introduced, we will have no problem getting an alternate bill introduced. And that's something that no other state generally does, because they don't have the capacity to write an alternate bill that anyone has enough confidence in that they can get a sponsor for. But if there is a return of this bill, which we expect there will be, we will either have our alternate bill that we will file simultaneously, or we will seek at a key point in the process to substitute our bill for their bad bill. or we will tack it on as amendment to their, I mean, there's a whole number of things we'll do, we will do, but just because they're going to bring it back doesn't mean they're going to be able to pass it. They've been trying since 2007 to pass things, including civil commitment here. So, I mean, sure, they'll come back. I don't want to sound arrogant about it, but we expect them to come back and keep trying.
We do. And we intend to fight them every step of the way.
All right. Well, let's go to another call. This one's been holding for a very long time. 810, you're on with Ashley.
I'm sorry to bother you. I had called before. I was looking for a Pennsylvania lawyer because it's something that you talked about in Mexico or New Mexico. But it applies here in Pennsylvania, too, is that I moved here and never had a hearing. You know, so there was no due process. And when I looked at my last registration, it says, well, you're registered for 15 years here. I'm like, well, who and when did that, was that decided? Plus, you know, we've got so much going on in the, you know, there's five cases that are before the Supreme Court right now in Pennsylvania. So there's a lot of issues, you know, like moving from, and I understand that's being challenged too. Like if in Michigan, I wouldn't be on the registry, but then move to Pennsylvania, that would be increasing, you know, it would still be an ex post facto thing, the way I understand it. Because, and the fact that there's the start date they used happened to be the day I moved here, not the 10 years I've already done on a registry. Is that being challenged at all in any state? Or
those are great questions. I'm going to put you in the mute status so that we don't get background, and then I'll try to go through them. In terms of your registration obligation in Pennsylvania, always think of it as comparable since it's a civil regulatory scheme until the court says it isn't. Now, in Pennsylvania, you're right, there's a lot of litigation, and all that could change because the Menez decision came down, and there's already been some findings about the unconstitutionality of the registry in Pennsylvania. But Pennsylvania may not have that clause that says it has to be an equivalent offense that to trigger a duty. Pennsylvania may have a clause that says if you have to register anywhere, you have to register there. Or they may have a clause that says something different, like if you have your tier system in Pennsylvania went into effect in 2012. And prior to that, if I remember right, it was just a 10-year obligation. But a state choosing you to give you, whether they choose to give you credit for a time in another jurisdiction, that's entirely up to the legislature, or if some successful challenge it goes through the courts and they say that you have to give them credit. But if that's not on the books, you're not going to get credit. But everybody in Pennsylvania, you've got the opportunity with all these cases that are before the Supreme Court that there could be some remarkable changes come about in registration in Pennsylvania. But Ashley, I think I'll let you go with anything I didn't cover.
No, I think that pretty much sums it up. And maybe what it is, do we have any Pennsylvania lawyers that are working on any of that stuff?
Well, the lead of all that has been the public in Philadelphia, but it's more than one person can do. So there's been a team of lawyers working on these various challenges. And then we had a lawyer named Leah Bickerton that was out of the Pittsburgh area, which is Allegheny County. She took a lot of questions for a while. I think she got overwhelmed with the number of people that, while she's on one of these phone calls, her next 2 weeks was tied up with people with registry questions. So I've just put her under the bus again. But you can look up the attorney Leah Bickerton. And she has an enormous amount of experience and knowledge, and is a no-nonsense. She actually gives you short answers if you say keep them short. I remember, Andy, you remember she gave me a one-word answer, yes? I said, is that possible? She said, yes.
Yes.
I said, do you want to expand on it? She said, no. but yeah, I don't feel like that Pennsylvania should be for us to go too deep into, because there's so much going on that we don't understand the challenges there. And it's really time for them to have another program on NARSL. And they have a group there, Teresa Robertson. I mean, you can reach out to the local affiliate in Pennsylvania, and they would probably be more helpful than what we can be. So, all right, let's take a call from Fred Flintstone. You're on NARSL in Action.
Yes. How are you doing? Thank you for taking my call. Two-part question. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
We're here.
Hello? Okay. Sort of two-part question. I'm in Florida. What happens if someone from Florida would move to Michigan with like a 1990s conviction? Would they still have to register from being out of state or not? And with your New Mexico law, the Florida charge was attempted lewd and lascivious on a child under 16. So that's the two parts about having to register in Michigan with a 90s conviction after this court case and New Mexico law.
When in the 90s? What year?
Excuse me?
What year in the
90s? 98, the crime happened. 99 was a conviction.
Okay. Larry, I'll let you field those.
When did you get off all obligations related to that crime? When did you get off paper?
It was 3 years afterwards. 98, okay, well, then so it'd be 2002.
Okay. If you were in completion of all obligations related to your offense by July 1, 2005, the worst case scenario would be that you would be under our registry version 1, which would be either an annual obligation once a year for 10 years, or be an annual obligation once a year for 20 years. You would get no credit for any of the time you spend in registering. So you'd be starting out 1 or 2 years, either 10 or 20 years from scratch. The translation, it could be, I mean, we can't get deep enough into it because it's based on what you actually did, the conduct that led to the conviction. So it could be, if you made obscene phone calls to a minor in Georgia, they would put you on the registry. We could quickly translate that. If that's all you did in Georgia, you wouldn't have to register here. We wouldn't have to do a deep analysis, but the crime you described would require a little fact finding to figure out what the factual basis was that was underlying your conviction. So you might have a 10-year, you might have a 20-year, and you might have no registration obligation at all as far as New Mexico. For Michigan, if the legislature takes no action whatsoever, which, as the lawyer alluded to, is an unlikely scenario, but if they were to take no action at all, anyone who with conduct that predated 2011, as the way he explained it, wouldn't have a registration obligation because the injunction would go in play in force. And I intended to ask the question. We ran short of time. I was going to ask, isn't this an invitation for U-Haul buses, U-Hauls and buses and everything to start making a direct assault on the state of Michigan? Because if I had to register in Florida and I could drive to Michigan and didn't have to register, I sure as hell would be driving there. And I know people are going to say, well, Larry, don't you understand? Florida doesn't release you from the registry. Well, Florida may not take your name off of the website. I get that. But what they do is they don't have any obligation. You have no obligation to pay Florida any money. You have no obligation to report to the registry office. You have no obligation to be constrained where you can live. You have no obligation to the state of Florida. So if all I had to do was be on the website and I could live in a state where I had no reporting or no constraints, now which would you choose?
Right. Well, I looked into Ohio years ago. Ohio had a law after 20 years. They gave you credit on the time, whatever state you come from. If you moved to Ohio, they gave you credit. And after 20 years, you were done. And I don't know if they changed that or not. Now, I know in Florida, what they're doing now in Florida is, and it was just in the newspaper again, another county, they're taking anybody that didn't register their license plate for their car, or rental car, or relative's car that's at their house. They're violating them, people, because it's now coming up on the 25 years where people have petitioned to get off the registry. And these people that they're nailing had convictions back in the late 90s or in the 90s and in the early 2000s where they're coming up on that time zone. And that, and the way the law is, any conviction, any subsequent, if ever you've been arrested after you completed your sentence, that stops your timeline. That makes it all restart again. So they're screwing. They're really screwing with people here in Florida.
Well, and if that's in the statute, so we don't have anything. Nothing tolls you in New Mexico. If you've got a 20-year obligation and you spend all 20 years in prison, now the DPS is going to argue that you have to register 20 times. Well, they may have a credible argument there. But I'm going to take the position you did your registration, you complete the period passed. But there's nothing in statute that says that there's any time told. So in Florida, I don't know what they have down there. But to answer your question, you could conceivably have a 10 or 20 year obligation in New Mexico, and in Michigan it's too murky.
But New Mexico would be level one though.
We don't have a level system. We don't have a level system here.
Oh, okay.
There's no distinguishing between the offenders here. It's you would have a 10 or 20 year period, but we don't refer to them as levels.
Oh, okay. Yeah, they don't have levels there in Florida either. They have like lifetime and that's it, or 25 years, I guess, or lifetime now. What they keep changing. When I first got on, it was 5 years, then it went to 10 years, and then I guess 20, then 25, and Florida's just a bunch of BS.
So I'm going to try to take one more caller before we shut down. So I appreciate your call. Thank you. Thank you. So I'm going to do one more call here from Erica 321. Go.
Yeah. The only question I actually have is I thought I heard, I believe it was you, say something earlier on, like an hour and a half ago, about an upcoming phone call and who was going to be on that phone call. Or did I misunderstand what you were saying? An upcoming narcotic calling call.
We try to do these on a more regular basis than what they've occurred since Halloween, but we will be seeking program material and people to be on the call. I think we are overdue to talk about Pennsylvania. We're overdue to talk about Illinois. There's a lot going on in Illinois. So I'd like to put more of these together, but it's quite an undertaking to line up the guests and promote it and organize the questions. These questions don't just flow when I'm sitting here. I put these questions together. I ask the attorneys, are they prepared to answer them? And we go back and forth to make sure that they understand what we're looking for. So it's quite an undertaking. We just don't sign on the air and start rambling. It's a preparation process that goes into getting one of these launched.
I understand that.
I don't have a schedule yet, but we will be doing more calls. And if you're on our email blast list, you'll get notice when we have the next one. But there's not one scheduled at the moment.
I am not on your email blast. I am not on email. I am not on the internet.
Well, how did you find out about this one?
From Barbara in St. Pete. Caution click.
Yeah, There's a possibility of having text alerts by phone, and we've discussed that. And I'm so don't know what it would take to set up that. But that's certainly something that I would like to have looked at. We've got a tech guru here. Why can't we do text alerts, Andy? Why can't we do text alerts to people who don't have email?
We totally can.
What would it involve? Be involved in setting up a text alert for people could sign up for.
I mean, I've done it for Georgia a number of times and kind of more like just playing around with it. It's not hard to do. You just have to craft a slightly different message, you know, that kind of fits into a 100-something characters instead of, you know, a 5,000-word email message. It's not expensive and it's doable.
Well, I think that for those who don't have access to getting the information, we should seriously consider that. Every time you add another step of complexity, it's more steps that have to be accomplished before you can launch. But this is not the first time we've heard that. All right. Well, I'm going to let one more call on from New Mexico. Thank you for listening. And did anybody claim the prize, Andy?
Nobody claimed the prize.
Do you want to draw another one? Because there's still people left here.
Let's go to the next one. 5387.
5387.
You've got seconds to try and claim this.
Yeah. Yeah. Because otherwise I'm just going to decide to give it to one of these people that didn't show up. All right, so I know who this is. This is from the Land of Enchantment. David from New Mexico, you're on Narcissan Action with Ashley Cloud. David fell asleep.
No, I'm here. I'm here. First and foremost, I want to thank you tremendously for all of your efforts. I know you don't hear it enough, so thank you very much. So I'll try to keep this very brief because I tend to be long-winded. I was convicted in 2004 in Colorado and sentenced to a 4-year indeterminate sentence. I served 8.5 years of that 4-year indeterminate sentence. My charges consist of an F3, which carries a 20-year mandatory supervision. But when I got to Colorado, my parole officer put it in as a 10-year supervision is what he recorded into the paperwork. So I've been kicking around the idea of this. Well, I've been listening to y'all talk about the 5-year review. I'm wondering if I should, one of the questions is I wonder if I should even bother aggravating this situation or just let them, let the 10 years expire and be released, you know, or should I go back to Colorado and address this thing prior to the 20 years that I know an F3 carries?
I can make it simple for you, David. On the 5-year review, you don't get that. You're not a New Mexico convicted person, so you need to put that out of your mind once. Okay,
all right, out of my mind.
Out of your mind.
Okay. Second thing I heard you all talking about was good time. In Colorado, sex offenders do not receive good time. Now, all other prisoners receive good time, especially the ones that engage in whatever programs or educational programs, or they receive up to X amount of time of good time. I never received any good time. Is that an addressable issue?
No, it's not an addressable issue because even the good time here is by statute. And that was part of the legislation they tried to pass too, was that they took away good time from sex offenders. So there, it's not addressable because it's statutory. However, let me ask you something on the 10-year. Here in New Mexico, because you're here on Interstate Compact, here in New Mexico, is it showing that you discharge at the 10-year mark?
No, because he's on indeterminate. You're on indeterminate. They have a positive release date on you here?
Well, within the paperwork that I signed at my parole office that day, the first day I showed up, he signed me up for 10 years worth of supervision and ankle bracelet. And there is an end date on that paperwork.
Well, you know, you might just sit back and see if they release you after 10 years.
Yeah, that's what I would do.
Right. And so I'm still in translation. I've been in translation, according to the Sheriff's Department, for the past 6 years.
One will have nothing to do with the other. One will have nothing to do with the other. You'll continue to have to register after you get off supervision. But how they translate your out-of-state sex offense will have nothing to do with how long you're supervised. That's all determined by the state that convicted you.
And if here on paper they're showing that you're discharged at the 10-year mark, that's what they'll submit a letter of discharge to Colorado. And that's – I'm with Larry. I think – you should just totally see if they do it.
Well, they do a notice of case closure is what they would do.
Mm-hmm.
But if Colorado doesn't want the case closed, they'll say, well, not so fast. Case doesn't get closed. It's indeterminate. But New Mexico is out of the loop on everything except for the registration.
Okay. Well, I recently called the head office over in Clovis, and I spoke with one of the head supervisors, and she said, how much longer are you on? I said, that's a good question. And so she looked it up on the computer and she said, you're on for 4 more years. If you just lay low for 4 more years, you're good. So I got it straight from them. That's what they're looking at on their computer.
I would just let that ride. Yeah.
All right.
Well, I know all what right. that looks like well, in there, so I would let it ride.
All right. Sounds good. Well, I won't take any more of your time. I appreciate you all so much. And I appreciate you all so much. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Take care.
Larry, we do have a winner.
All right, we'll do.
We do have a winner. Let's hear that drum roll. Who won the illustrious play?
An individual named Mike from the 916 area code. And I sent you the information.
I will process that and get him registered for the conference if he so desires.
Very well.
So I see that number in my messages.
Yep.
Winner. Well, are we ready to shut down this podcast?
Ashley,
did you have any closing words? Because Andy's past his bedtime.
It's late where you're at, Andy.
Yes, it is. I'm ready for bed.
I hear you. Well, I want to thank everybody that hung with us this long and that we still had questions going into this hour. I'm deeply appreciative for everybody out there and their support. And thank you, Larry, as always. And thank you, Andy, as always.
Thank you.
Well, we had over 50 hanging in here to the very end. So
And I'm sorry about the troubles with YouTube, because that just went beyond me. Just couldn't get connected.
Well, they just had to call in on the old-fashioned phone if they wanted to continue listening, right?
That is correct.
So, well, all right. Well, we're going to sign off, and hopefully we'll get another one of these programs put together. I'm seeking volunteers to do what I do. And you don't have to do it the same way I do it. There may be a different way that's more efficient and more exciting than all the work I put into it. But I tend to want to go through questions that have been prepared. I don't like to have long monologues and all this storytelling. So I'm trying to cover a lot of territory. I let a lot of storytelling go on tonight that I really shouldn't have. But you know, you're always trying to balance one way or the other. If you cut off the attorney too soon, they don't want to come back. And so I was a little tolerant of storytelling tonight. But all right, everybody, this is it.
Thank you, everybody. Good night.
Good night from Marshall.
Good night.
Okay, I'm going to stop the recording. If I can figure out how I'll do it, I hit off.
This session is no longer being recorded.
That's done. And there's people beginning to hang up that were still there. So I can unmute everybody and see if anybody wants to say anything.
Q&A session is over.
Well, hello,